Chapter 10. Perhaps eating had something to do with it. Not even pausing while he tried with no particular interest nor curiosity to compute how many days since he had sat down to a table to eat, and then in the same chew, as it were, remembering that it had not been one yet, since even though already half asleep he had eaten a good breakfast at the sheriff's at 4 this morning. Remembering how his uncle, sitting across the table drinking coffee, had said that man didn't necessarily eat his way through the world, but by the act of eating, and maybe only by that, did he actually enter the world, get himself into the world. Not through it, but into it, burrowing into the world's teeming solidarity like a moth into wool by the physical act of chewing and swallowing the substance of its warp and woof, and so making, translating into a part of himself and his memory, the whole history of man, or maybe even relinquishing by mastication, abandoning, eating it into, to be annealed, the proud, vainglorious minuscule which he called his memory and his self and his I am into that vast, teeming, anonymous solidarity of the world from beneath, which the ephemeral rock would cool and spin away to dust, not even remarked and remembered, since there was no yesterday and tomorrow didn't even exist. So maybe only an ascetic living in a cave on acorns and spring water was really capable of vainglory and pride. Maybe you had to live in a cave on acorns and spring water, enwrapped, impregnable contemplation of your vainglory and righteousness and pride, in order to keep up to that high, intolerant pitch of its worship, which brooked no compromise. Eating steadily, and quite a lot, too, and at what even he knew by this time was too fast, since he had been hearing it for 16 years, and put his napkin down, and rose, and one last wail from his mother. And he thought how women couldn't really stand anything except tragedy and poverty and physical pain. How this morning, when he was where at 16 he had no business being and doing what even at twice 16 he had no business doing— chasing over the country with the sheriff, digging up murdered corpses out of a ditch. She had been 100 times less noisy than his father and 1,000 times more valuable. Yet now, when all he intended was to walk to town with his uncle and sit for an hour or so in the same office in which he had already spent a probably elapsed quarter of his life, she had completely abolished Lucas Beecham and Crawford Gowrey both, and had gone back, indefatigable, to the day 15 years ago when she had first set out to persuade him he couldn't button his pants. "But why can't Miss Habersham come here to wait?" "She can," his uncle said. "I'm sure she can find the house again."
"You know what I mean," she said. "Why don't you make her? Sitting around a lawyer's office until 12 o'clock at night is no place for a lady."
"Neither was digging up Jake Montgomery last night," his uncle said. "But maybe this time we will break Lucas Beecham of making this constant drain on her gentility. Come along, chick." And so out of the house at last, not walking out of the house into it, because he had brought it out of the house with him, having at some point between his room and the front door not acquired it, nor even simply entered it, nor even actually regained it, but rather expiated his aberration from it, become once more worthy to be received into it, since it was his own, or rather, he was its, and so it must have been the eating. He and his uncle once more walking the same street almost exactly as they had walked it not 22 hours ago, which had been empty then with a sort of aghast, recoiled consternation, because it was not empty at all now, deserted and empty of movement, certainly running as vacant of life from street lamp to street lamp as a dead street through an abandoned city, but not really abandoned, not really withdrawn, but only making way for them who could do it better, only making way for them who could do it right, not to interfere or get in the way or even offer suggestion or even permit, with thanks, advice to them who would do it right, and in their own homely way, since it was their own grief and their own shame and their own expiation, laughing again now, but it was all right. Thinking, because they always have me and Alexander and Miss Habersham, not to mention Uncle Gavin and a sworn badge-wearing sheriff. When suddenly he realized that that was a part of it too. That fierce desire that they should be perfect because they were his and he was theirs. That furious intolerance of any one single jot or tittle less than absolute perfection. That furious, almost instinctive leap and spring to defend them from anyone, anywhere, so that he might excoriate them himself without mercy, since they were his own and he wanted no more save to stand with them, unalterable and impregnable. One shame, if shame must be. One expiation, since expiation must surely be, but above all, one unalterable, durable, impregnable one. One people, one heart, one land. So that suddenly he said, "Look," and stopped, but as always, no more was needed. "Yes," his uncle said. Then when he said no more, I see. It's not that they were right, but that you were wrong. It was worse, he said. I was righteous. It's all right to be righteous, his uncle said. Maybe you were right and they were wrong. Just don't stop. Don't stop what? He said. Even bragging and boasting is all right, too, his uncle said. Just don't stop. Don't stop what? He said again. But he knew what now. He said, "Ain't it about time you stopped being a tenderfoot scout too?" "This is not tenderfoot," his uncle said. "This is the third degree. What do you call it?"
"Eagle scout," he said.
"Eagle scout," his uncle said. "Tenderfoot is don't accept. Eagle scout is don't stop. You see?" "No, that's wrong. Don't bother to see. Don't even bother to not forget it. Just don't stop." "No," he said. "We don't need to worry about stopping now. It seems to me what we have to worry about now is where we're going and how." "Yes, you do," his uncle said. "You told me yourself about 15 minutes ago, don't you remember? About what Mr. Hampton and Lucas were going to use for bait to fetch Crawford Gowrie in to where they could put Mr. Hampton's hand on him? They're going to use Lucas." And he would remember. Himself and his uncle standing beside the sheriff's car in the alley beside the jail, watching Lucas and the sheriff emerge from the jail's side door and cross the dark yard toward them. It was quite dark, in fact, since the street light at the corner didn't reach this far, nor any sound either. Only a little after 10 o'clock, and on Monday night, too, yet the sky's dark bowl cupped as though in a vacuum, like the old bride's bouquet under its glass bell, the town, the square, which was more than dead. Abandoned. Because he had gone on to look at it, without stopping, leaving his uncle standing at the corner of the alley, who said after him, "Where are you going?" But not even answering. Walking the last silent and empty block, ringing his footfalls deliberate and unsecret into the hollow silence. Unhurried and solitary, but nothing at all of forlorn. Instead, with a sense, a feeling not possessive but proprietary, vice-jural, with humility still. Himself not potent, but at least the vessel of a potency, like the actor looking from wings or perhaps empty balcony down upon the waiting stage, vacant yet garnished and empty yet. Nevertheless, where in a moment now he will walk and posture in the last act's absolute cynosure. Himself in himself, nothing and maybe no world-beater of a play either, but at least his to finish it. Round it and put it away intact and unassailable, complete. and so on to into the dark and empty square, stopping as soon as he could perceive, at effortless once, that whole dark, lifeless rectangle with but one light anywhere, and that in the café, which stayed open all night on account of the long-haul trucks whose, the café's, real purpose, some said, the real reason for the grant of its license by the town was to keep Willie Ingram's nocturnal counterpart awake, who, although the town had walled him off a little cubbyhole of an office in an alley with a stove and a telephone, he wouldn't stay there, but used instead the café where there was somebody to talk to, and he could be telephoned there, of course, but some people, old ladies especially, didn't like to page the policeman in an all-night juke joint coffee stall. So the office telephone had been connected to a big burglar alarm bell on the outside wall, loud enough for the counterman or a truck driver in the café to hear it and tell him it was ringing. And the two lighted second-story windows. And he thought that Miss Habersham really had persuaded his uncle to give her the key to the office. And then he thought that that was wrong. His uncle had persuaded her to take the key since she would just as soon have sat in the parked truck until they came. And then added, if she had waited, because that was certainly wrong, and what had really happened was that his uncle had locked her up in the office to give the sheriff and Lucas time to get out of town. But since the lights in a lawyer's office were liable to burn any time the lawyer or the janitor forgot to turn them off when they left, and the café, like the power plant, was a public institution, they didn't count, and even the café was just lighted. He couldn't see into it from here, but he could have heard, and he thought how that formally shutting off the jukebox for 12 hours had probably been the night marshal's first official act, besides punching every hour the time clock on the wall at the bank's back door since the mad dog scare last August. And he remembered the other, the normal Monday nights when no loud fury of blood and revenge and racial and family solidarity had come roaring in from beat 4, or beat 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 for that matter, or for the matter of that, from the purlieus of the urban Georgian porticos themselves, to rattle and clash among the old bricks and the old trees and the Doric capitals and leave them for one night anyway stricken. 10 o'clock on Monday night, and although the first run of the film at the picture show would be 40 or 50 minutes over now, a few of the patrons who had come in late would still be passing homeward, and all the young men sitting since that time drinking Coca-Cola and playing nickels into the drugstore jukebox would certainly be strolling timeless and in no haste, since they were going nowhere, since the May night itself was their destination, and they carried that with them, walking in it, and, stock auction day, even a few belated cars and trucks, whose occupants had stayed in for the picture show too, or to visit and take supper with kin or friends, and now at last dispersing nightward, sleepward, tomorrowward, about the dark, mile-compassing land, remembering no longer ago than last night when he had thought it was empty too, until he had had time to listen to it a moment and realized that it was not empty at all. A Sunday night, but with more than Sunday night's quiet. The sort of quiet, in fact, that no night had any business with, and of all nights, Sunday night never, which had been Sunday night only because they had already named the calendar when the sheriff brought Lucas into jail. An emptiness you could call emptiness, provided you called vacant and empty the silent and lifeless terrain in front of a mobilized army, or peaceful the vestibule to a powder magazine, or quiet the spillway under the locks of a dam. A sense not of waiting, but of incrementation, not of people, women and old folks and children, but of men not so much grim as grave, and not so much tense as quiet. Sitting quietly and not even talking much in back rooms, and not just the bath cabinets and John's behind the barbershop and the shed behind the pool hall, stacked with soft drink cases and littered with empty whiskey bottles, but the stock rooms of stores and garages, and behind the drawn shades of the offices themselves, whose owners, even the proprietors of the stores and garages, conceded to belong not to a trade but a profession. Not waiting for an event, a moment in time to come to them, but for a moment in time when, in almost volitionless concord, they themselves would create the event, preside at, and even serve an instant which was not even 6 or 12 or 15 hours belated, but was instead simply the continuation of the one when the bullet struck Vincent Gowrie, and there had been no time between. And so for all purposes, Lucas was already dead, since he had died then on the same instant when he had forfeited his life. And theirs was merely to preside at his settee, and now, tonight, to remember, because tomorrow it would be over. Tomorrow, of course, the square would wake and stir. Another day, and it would fling off hangover. Another, and it would even fling off shame, so that on Saturday, the whole county, with one pierceless unanimity of click and pulse and hum, would even deny that the moment had ever existed when they could have been mistaken. So that he didn't even need to remind himself in the absolute, the utter, the complete silence that the town was not dead, nor even abandoned, but only withdrawn, giving room to do what homely thing must be done in its own homely way, without help or interference or even, thank you, advice. Three amateurs, an old white spinster and a white child and a black one, to expose Lucas's would-be murderer. Lucas himself and the county sheriff to catch him, and so, one last time, remembering. His uncle, while he still stood barefoot on the rug, with both edges of the unbuttoned shirt arrested in his hands 30 minutes ago, and when they were mounting the last pitch of hill toward the church 11 hours ago, and on what must have been 1,000 other times since he had got big enough to listen and to understand and to remember. To defend not Lucas, nor even the Union of the United States, but the United States from the outlanders, north, east, and west, who with the highest of motives and intentions, let us say, are essaying to divide it at a time when no people dare risk division by using federal laws and federal police to abolish Lucas's shameful condition. There may not be in any random 1,000 Southerners one who really grieves, or even is really concerned over that condition. Nevertheless, neither is there always one who would himself lynch Lucas, no matter what the occasion. Yet not one of that 999, plus that other, first one making the 1,000 whole again, would hesitate to repulse with force, and one would still be that lyncher. The outlander who came down here with force to intervene or punish him. You say, with sneer, you must know Sambo well to arrogate to yourself such calm assumption of his passivity. And I reply, I don't know him at all, and in my opinion no white man does, but I do know the southern white man. Not only the 999, but that other one, too, because he is our own, too, and more than that. That one other does not exist only in the South. You will see allied not North and East and West, and Sambo against a handful of white men in the South, but a paper alliance of theorists and fanatics and private and personal avengers, plus a number of others under the assumption of enough physical miles to afford a principle against and possibly even outnumbered a concorded South, which has drawn recruits, whether it would or no, from your own back areas. Not just your hinterland, but the fine cities of your cultural pride, your Chicago's and Detroit's and Los Angeles's, and wherever else live ignorant people who fear the color of any skin or shape of nose save their own, and who will grasp this opportunity to vent on Sambo the whole sum of their ancestral horror and scorn and fear of Indian and Chinese and Mexican and Carib and Jew. You will force us, the one out of that first random 1,000 and the 999 out of the second, who do begrieve Lucas's shameful condition and would improve it, and have and are and will until, not tomorrow perhaps,
That condition will be abolished, to be not forgotten maybe, but at least remembered with less of pain and bitterness, since justice was relinquished to him by us rather than torn from us and forced on him both with bayonets, willy-nilly into alliance with them with whom we have no kinship whatever, in defense of a principle which we ourselves begrieve and abhor. We are in the position of the German after 1933, who had no other alternative between being either a Nazi or a Jew, or the present Russian, European too, for that matter, who hasn't even that, but must be either a communist or dead. Only we must do it, and we alone, without help or interference or even, thank you, advice, since only we can, if Lucas's equality is to be anything more than its own prisoner, inside an impregnable barricade of the direct heirs of the victory of 1861 to 1865, which probably did more than even John Brown to stalemate Lucas's freedom, which still seems to be in check going on 100 years after Lee surrendered. And when you say Lucas must not wait for that tomorrow, because that tomorrow will never come, because you not only can't, you won't, then we can only repeat, then you shall not, and say to you, come down here and look at us before you make up your mind. And you reply, no thanks. The smell is bad enough from here. And we say, surely you will at least look at the dog you planned to housebreak. A people divided at a time when history is still showing us that the anteroom to dissolution is division. And you say, at least we perish in the name of humanity. And we reply, when all is stricken but that nominative pronoun and that verb, what price Lucas's humanity then? And turned and ran the short, dead, empty block back to the corner where his uncle had gone on without waiting, and then up the alley too to where the sheriff's car stood, the two of them watching the sheriff and Lucas cross the dark yard toward them, the sheriff in front and Lucas about 5 feet behind, walking not fast but just intently, neither furtive nor covert, but exactly like two men simply busy, not exactly late but with no time to dawdle, through the gate and across to the car where the sheriff opened the back door and said, jump in. And Lucas got in, and the sheriff closed the door and opened the front one and crawled grunting into it, the whole car squatting onto its springs and rims when he let himself down into the seat and turned the switch and started the engine, his uncle standing at the window now holding the rim of it in both hands as though he thought or hoped suddenly on some second thought to hold the car motionless before it could begin to move, saying what he himself had been thinking off and on for 30 or 40 minutes. Take somebody with you. I am, the sheriff said. Besides, I thought we settled all this 3 times this afternoon. That's still just one, no matter how many times you count, Lucas, his uncle said. You let me have my pistol, Lucas said, and won't nobody have to do no counting. I'll do it. And he thought how many times the sheriff had probably told Lucas by now to shut up, which may have been why the sheriff didn't say it now. Except that, suddenly, he did, turning slowly and heavily and grunting in the seat to look back at Lucas, saying in the plaintive, heavily sighing voice, after all the trouble you got into Saturday standing with that pistol in your pocket in the same 10 feet of air a Gowrie was standing in, you want to take it in your hand and walk around another one. Now I want you to hush and stay hushed. And when we begin to get close to White Leaf Bridge, I want you to be laying on the floor close up against the seat behind me and still hushed. You hear me? I hear you, Lucas said. But if I just have my pistol. But the sheriff had already turned to his uncle. No matter how many times you count Crawford Gowrie, he's still just one, too. And then went on in the mild, sighing, reluctant voice, which nevertheless was already answering his uncle's thoughts before even his uncle could speak it. Who would he get?
And he thought of that, too, remembering the long, tearing rubber-from-cement sound of the frantic cars and trucks scattering pell-mell, hurling themselves in a ghast, irrevocable repudiation in all directions toward the county's outmost, unmapped fastnesses, except that little island in Beat 4 known as Caledonia Church, into sanctuary. The old, the used, the familiar home where the women and older girls and children could milk and chop wood for tomorrow's breakfast, while the little ones held lanterns and the men and older sons, after they had fed the mules against tomorrow's plowing, would sit on the front gallery waiting for supper into the twilight. The whippoorwills. Night. Sleep. And this he could even see, provided that even a murderer's infatuation could bring Crawford Gowrie ever again into the range and radius of that nub arm, which, since Crawford was a Gowrie too, in agreement here with the sheriff he didn't believe, and he knew now why Lucas had ever left Fraser's store alive Saturday afternoon, let alone ever got out of the sheriff's car at the jail. That the Gowries themselves had known he hadn't done it, so they were just marking time waiting for somebody else, maybe Jefferson, to drag him out into the street until he remembered. A flash, something like shame. The blue shirt squatting and the stiff, awkward single hand trying to brush the wet sand from the dead face, and he knew that whatever the furious old man might begin to think tomorrow, he held nothing against Lucas then, because there was no room for anything but his son. Night. The dining room, perhaps, and again, seven Gowrie men in the 20-year womanless house, because Forrest had come up from Vicksburg for the funeral yesterday and was probably still there this morning when the sheriff sent word out for old Gowrie to meet him at the church. A lamp burning in the center of the table among the crusted sugar bowls and molasses jugs and ketchup and salt and pepper in the same labeled containers they had come off the store shelf in. And the old man sitting at the head of it, his one arm lying on the table in front of him, and the big pistol under his hand, pronouncing judgment, sentence, doom, and execution too on the Gowrie who had canceled his own Gowriehood with his brother's blood. Then the dark road, the truck, not commandeered this time because Vincent had owned one new and big and powerful convertible for either logs or cattle. The same twin driving it, probably, and the body boomed down onto the running gear like a log itself with the heavy log chains. Fast out of Caledonia, out of Beat 4, into the dark, silent, waiting town. Fast, still, up the quiet street across the square to the sheriff's house. And the body tumbled and flung onto the sheriff's front gallery. And perhaps the truck even waiting while the other Gowrie twin rang the doorbell. "Stop worrying about Crawford," the sheriff said. "He ain't got anything against me. He votes for me. His trouble right now is having to kill extra folks like Jake Montgomery when all he ever wanted was just to keep Vincent from finding out he had been stealing lumber from him and Uncle Sudley Workit. Even if he jumps onto the running board before I have time to keep up with what's going on, he'll still have to waste a minute or two trying to get the door open so he can see exactly where Lucas is. Provided by that time Lucas is doing good and hard what I told him to do, which I sure hope for his sake he is." "I'm going to," Lucas said. "But if I just had my..." "Yes," his uncle said in the harsh voice. "Provided he's there." The sheriff sighed. "You sent the message." "What message I could," his uncle said. "However I could. A message making an assignation between a murderer and a policeman, that whoever finally delivers it to the murderer won't even know was intended for the murderer, that the murderer himself will not only believe he wasn't intended to get it, but that it's true."
"Well," the sheriff said, "he'll either get it or he won't get it, and he'll either believe it or he won't believe it, and he'll either be waiting for us in White Leaf Bottom or he won't. And if he ain't, me and Lucas will go on to the highway and come back to town."
He raced the engine, let it idle again, Now he turned on the lights.
But he may be there. I sent a message, too.
All right, his uncle said. Why is that, Mr. Bones?
I got the mayor to excuse Willie Ingram so he could go out and set up with Vincent again tonight. And before Willie left, I told him in confidence I was going to run Lucas over to Hollymount tonight through the old white leaf cutout so Lucas can testify tomorrow at Jake Montgomery's inquest. And reminded Willie that they ain't finished the white leaf fill yet and cars have to cross it in low gear, and told him to be sure not to mention it to anybody.
Oh, his uncle said, not quite turning the door loose yet. No matter who might have claimed Jake Montgomery alive, he belongs to Yoknapatawpha County now. But then, he said briskly, turning the door loose now, we're after just a murderer, not a lawyer. All right, he said. Why don't you get started?
Yes, the sheriff said. You go on to your office and watch out for Miss Eunice. Willie may have passed her on the street, too, and if he did, she might still beat us to White Leaf Bridge in that pickup.
Then into the square this time, to cross it catacornered to where the pickup stood nosed in, empty to the otherwise empty curb, and up the long, muted groan and rumble of the stairway to the open office door. And passing through it, he thought without surprise how she was probably the only woman he knew who would have withdrawn the borrowed key from the lock as soon as she opened the strange door, not to leave the key on the first flat surface she passed, but to put it back into the reticule or pocket or whatever she had put it in when it was lent to her, and she wouldn't be sitting in the chair behind the table either, and wasn't. Sitting instead, bolt upright in the hat, but another dress, which looked exactly like the one she had worn last night, and the same handbag on her lap with the $18 gloves clasped on top of it, and the flat-heeled $30 shoes planted side by side on the floor in front of the hardest, straightest chair in the room. The one beside the door which nobody ever really sat in, no matter how crowded the office, and only moving to the easy chair behind the table after his uncle had spent a good 10 minutes insisting, and finally explained it might be 2 or 3 hours yet, because she had the gold brooch watch on her bosom open when they came in, and seemed to think that by this time the sheriff should not only have been back with Crawford Gowrie, but probably on the way to the penitentiary with him. Then he in his usual chair beside the water cooler, and finally his uncle even struck the match to the cob pipe, still talking, not just through the smoke, but into it, with it. What happened because some of it we even know, let alone what Lucas finally told us by watching himself like a hawk or an international spy to keep from telling us anything that would even explain him, let alone save him. Vincent and Crawford were partners buying the timber from old man Sudley Workett, who was Mrs. Gowrie's second or fourth cousin or uncle or something. That is, they had agreed with old Sudley on a price by the board foot, but to be paid him when the lumber was sold, which was not to be until the last tree was cut, and Crawford and Vincent had delivered it and got their money, and then they would pay old Sudley his. Hiring a mill and crew to fell and saw and stack it right there within a mile of old Sudley's house, and not one stick to be moved until it was all cut. Only, except this part we don't really know yet until Hampton gets his hands on Crawford, except it's got to be this way, or what in the world were you all doing digging Jake Montgomery out of Vincent's grave? And every time I think about this part of it and remember you three coming back down that hill to the exact spot where two of you heard him and one of you even saw riding past the man who already, with one murdered corpse on the mule in front of him, experienced such a sudden and urgent alteration of plan that when Hampton and I got there, hardly 6 hours later, there was nobody in the grave at all. But he didn't, Miss Habersham said.
What?
His uncle said.
Where was I?
Oh, yes. Only Lucas Beecham, taking his walk one night, heard something and went and looked. Or maybe he was actually passing and saw. Or maybe he already had the idea, which was why he took the walk or that walk that night. and saw a truck, whether he recognized it or not, being loaded in the dark with that lumber which the whole neighborhood knew was not to be moved until the mill itself closed up and moved away, which would be some time yet, and Lucas watched and listened, and maybe he even went over into Crossman County to Glasgow and Hollymount until he knew for sure not only who was moving some of that lumber every night or so, not much at a time, just exactly not quite enough for anyone who was not there every day to notice its absence. And the only people there every day, or even interested even to that extent, were Crawford, who represented himself and his brother and uncle, who owned the trees and the resulting lumber, and so could do what they liked with it, the one of which was running about the country all day long attending to his other hot irons, and the other an old rheumatic man to begin with, and half blind on top of that, who couldn't have seen anything even if he could have got that far from his house. And the mill crew, who were hired by the day and so wouldn't have cared even if they had known what was going on at night as long as they got their pay every Saturday. But what he was doing with it, maybe learning even as far as Jake Montgomery, though Lucas's knowing about Jake made no difference except that by getting himself murdered and into Vincent's grave, Jake probably saved Lucas's life. But even when Hope told me how he had finally got that much out of Lucas in his kitchen this morning, when Will Leggett brought him from the jail and we were driving you home, it explained only part of it, because I was still saying what I had been saying ever since you all woke me this morning and Chick told me what Lucas had told him about the pistol. But why Vincent? Why did Crawford have to kill Vincent in order to obliterate the witness to his thieving? Not that it shouldn't have worked, of course, since Lucas really should have died as soon as the first white man came inside of him, standing over Vincent's body with the handle of that pistol hunched in the back of his coat. But why do it this way, by the bizarre detour of fratricide? So now that we had something really heavy enough to talk to Lucas with, I went straight to Hampton's house this afternoon into the kitchen, and there was Hampton's cook sitting on one side of the table and Lucas on the other, eating greens and cornbread, not from a plate, but out of the 2-gallon pot itself. And I said, "And you let him catch you?" And I don't mean Crawford. And he said, "No, I means Vincent, too." Only it was too late then. The truck was done already loaded and pulling out fast with no lights burning or nothing. And he said, "Whose truck is that?" And I never said nothing. "All right," I said. "Then what?" "That's all," Lucas said. "Nothing." "Didn't he have a gun?" "I don't know," Lucas said. "He had a stick." And I said, "All right. Go on." And he said, "Nothing. He just stood there a minute with the stick drawn back and said, 'Tell me whose truck that was,' and I never said nothing. And he lowered the stick back down and turned, and then I never saw him no more." "So you took your pistol," I said, and he said, "and went," and he said, "I never had to. He come to me. I mean Crawford this time, at my house the next night, and was going to pay me to tell him whose truck that was. A heap of money. $50. He showed it to me, and I said I hadn't decided yet whose truck it was, and he said he would leave me the money anyhow while I decided, and I said I had already decided what I was going to do. I will wait until tomorrow." That was Friday night, for some kind of evidence that Mr. Workett and Vincent had got their share of that missing timber money. "Yes," I said. "Then what?" "Then I will go and tell Mr. Workett he better..." "Say that again," I said. "Slow. Tell Mr. Workett he better count his boards. And you, a Negro, were going up to a white man and tell him his niece's sons were stealing from him. And a beat for a white man on top of that. Don't you know what would have happened to you?" "It never had no chance," he said. "Because it was the next day, Saturday, I got the message. And I should have known then about the pistol, because obviously Gowrie knew about it. His message couldn't have been, 'Have replaced stolen money, would like your personal approval, bring your pistol and be sociable.' Something like that. So I said, 'But why the pistol?' And he said,
It was Saturday. And I said, yes, the 9th. But why the pistol? And then I understood. I said, I see. You wear the pistol when you dress up on Saturday, just like old Carruthers did before he gave it to you. And he said, sold it to me. And I said, all right, go on. And he said, got the message to meet him at the store, only... And now his uncle struck the match again and puffed the pipe, still talking, talking through the pipe stem with the smoke as though you were watching the words themselves. Only he never got to the store. Crawford met him in the woods, sitting on a stump beside the path, waiting for him, almost before Lucas had left home good, and now it was Crawford about the pistol. Right off before Lucas could say good afternoon, or were Vincent and Mr. Workit glad to get the money or anything, saying, even if it will still shoot, you probably couldn't hit anything with it, and so you can probably finish it yourself. Lucas said how Crawford finally put up a half dollar that Lucas couldn't hit the stump from 15 feet away, and Lucas hit it, and Crawford gave him the half dollar, and they walked on the other 2 miles toward the store until Crawford told Lucas to wait there, that Mr. Workit was sending a signed receipt for his share of the missing lumber to the store, and Crawford would go and fetch it back so Lucas could see it with his own eyes. And I said, and you didn't suspicion anything even then? And he said, no, he cussed me so natural. And at least you can finish that. No need to prove any quarrel between Vincent and Crawford, nor rack your brains very deep to imagine what Crawford said and did to have Vincent waiting at the store, and then send him in front along the path, since no more than this will do it. All right, I've got him. If he still won't tell whose truck that was, we'll beat it out of him. Because that doesn't really matter either. Enough that the next Lucas saw was Vincent coming down the path from the store in a good deal of a hurry, Lucas said, but probably what he meant was impatient. Puzzled and annoyed both, but probably mostly annoyed. Probably doing exactly what Lucas was doing. Waiting for the other to speak and explain, except that Vincent quit waiting first, according to Lucas. Still walking, saying, getting as far as, so you changed your mind, when Lucas said he tripped over something and kind of bucked down onto his face, and presently Lucas remembered that he had heard the shot and realized that what Vincent had tripped over was his brother Crawford. Then the rest of them were there, Lucas said, before he even had time to hear them running through the woods. And I said, I reckon it looked to you right then that you were getting ready to trip pretty bad over Vincent, old Skipworth and Adam Fraser or not. But at least I didn't say, but why didn't you explain then? And so at least Lucas didn't have to say explain what to who. And so he was all right. I don't mean Lucas, of course. I mean Crawford. No mere child of misfortune, he. And there it was again, and this time he knew what it was. Miss Habersham had done something he didn't know what. No sound, and she hadn't moved, and it wasn't even that she had got any stiller, but something had occurred. Not something happened to her from the outside in, but something from the inside outward, as though she not only hadn't been surprised by it, but had decreed, authorized it, but she hadn't moved at all, not even to take an extra breath, and his uncle hadn't even noticed that much. But rather chosen and elected peculiar and unique out of man by the gods themselves to prove not to themselves, because they had never doubted it, but to man by this, his lowest common denominator, that he has a soul, driven at last to murder his brother. He put him in quicksand, Miss Habersham said. Yes, his uncle said. Ghastly, wasn't it? By the simple mischance of an old Negro man's insomnambulism, and then having got away with that by means of a plan, a scheme so simple and watertight in its biological and geographical psychology as to be what Chick here would call a natural,
then to be foiled here by the fact that 4 years ago a child whose presence in the world he was not even aware of fell into a creek in the presence of that same Negro insomnambulist, because this part we don't really know either, and with Jake Montgomery in his present condition, we probably never will, though that doesn't really matter either, since the fact still remains. Why else was he in Vincent's grave except that in buying the lumber from Crawford, we found that out by a telephone call to the lumber's ultimate consignee in Memphis this afternoon. Jake Montgomery knew where it came from, too, since knowing that would have been Jake's nature and character, too, and indeed a factor in his middleman's profit. And so when Vincent, Crawford's partner, tripped suddenly on death in the woods behind Fraser's store, Jake didn't need a crystal ball to read that either. And so if this be surmise, then make the most of it, or give Mr. Hampton and me a better and we'll swap. Jake knew about Buddy McCallum's old war trophy, too, and I like to think for Crawford's sake. And there it was again, and still no outward sign, but this time his uncle saw or felt or sensed, or however it was, it too, and stopped, and even for a second seemed about to speak, then in the next one forgot it, apparently, talking again. That maybe Jake named the price of his silence and even collected it, or an installment on it, perhaps, intending all the time to convict Crawford of the murder. Perhaps with his contacts all established to get still more money, or perhaps he didn't like Crawford and wanted revenge. Or perhaps, a purist, he drew the line at murder and simply dug Vincent up to load him on the mule and take him in to the sheriff. But anyway, on the night after the funeral, somebody with a conceivable reason for digging Vincent up dug him up, which must have been Jake. And somebody who not only didn't want Vincent dug up, but had a conceivable reason to be watching the someone who would have had a conceivable reason for digging him up, knew that he had been dug up within it. You said it was about 10 when you and Alexander parked the truck, and it got dark enough for digging up graves about 7 that night, so that leaves 3 hours. And that's what I mean about Crawford, his uncle said. And this time he noticed that his uncle had even stopped, expecting it, and it came, but still no sound, no movement. The hat immobile and exact, the neat precision of the clasped gloves and the handbag on her lap, the shoes planted and motionless, side by side, as if she had placed them into a chalked diagram on the floor. Watching there in the weeds behind the fence, seeing himself not merely betrayed out of the blackmail, but all the agony and suspense to go through again, not to mention the physical labor, who since one man already knew that the body couldn't bear examination by trained policemen, could never know how many others might know or suspect, so the body would have to come out of the grave now, though at least he had help here, whether the help knew it or not. So he probably waited until Jake had the body out and was all ready to load it onto the mule. And we found that out, too. It was the Gowrie's plow mule, the same one the twins were riding this morning. Jake borrowed it himself late that Sunday afternoon, and when you guess which Gowrie he borrowed it from, you'll be right. It was Crawford. And he wouldn't have risked the pistol now anyway, any more than he would have used it if he could. Who would rather have paid Jake over again the amount of the blackmail for the privilege of using whatever it was he crushed Jake's skull with and put him into the coffin and filled the grave back up? And here it is again. The desperate, the dreadful urgency, the loneliness, the pariahhood, having not only the horror and repudiation of all man against him, but having to struggle with the sheer inertia of earth and the terrible, heedless rush of time, but even beating all that coalition at last, the grave, decent again, even to the displaced flowers and the evidence of his original crime at last disposed and secure. And it would have been again, but this time his uncle didn't pause. Then to straighten up at last and for the first time draw a full breath since the moment when Jake had approached him, rubbing his thumb against the tips of the same fingers. And then to hear whatever it was that sent him plunging back up the hill, then crawling, creeping to lie once more panting, but this time not merely in rage and terror, but in almost incredulous disbelief that one single man could be subject to this much bad luck. Watching you three not only undo his work for the second time, but double it now, since you not only exposed Jake Montgomery, but you refilled the grave and even put the flowers back. Who couldn't afford to let his brother Vincent be found in that grave, but durst not let Jake Montgomery be found in it when, as he must have known, Hope Hampton got there tomorrow. And stopped this time, waiting for her to say it. And she did. He put his brother in quicksand. Ah, his uncle said. That moment may come to anyone when simply nothing remains to be done with your brother or husband or uncle or cousin or mother-in-law except destroy them. But you don't put them in quicksand. Is that it? He put him in quicksand, she said, with calm and implacable finality, not moving nor stirring except her lips to speak. Until then she raised her hand and opened the watch pinned to her bosom and looked at it. They haven't reached Whiteleaf Bottom yet, his uncle said. But don't worry. He'll be there. My message might have reached him, but no man in this county can possibly escape hearing anything ever told Willie Ingram under the pledge of secrecy. Because there's nothing else he can do, you see, because murderers are gamblers. And like the amateur gambler, the amateur murderer believes first not in his luck, but in long shots. That the long shot will win simply because it's a long shot, but besides that, say he already knew he was lost, and nothing Lucas could testify about Jake Montgomery or anyone else could harm him further, and that his one last slim chance was to get out of the country. Or say he knew even that was vain, knew for sure that he was running through the last few pence and pennies of what he could still call freedom. Suppose he even knew for certain that tomorrow's sun would not even rise for him. What would you want to do first? One last act and statement of your deathless principles before you left your native land for good, and maybe even the world for good, if your name was Gowrie, and your blood and thinking and acting had been Gowrie all your life, and you knew or even only believed or even only hoped that at a certain moment in an automobile creeping in low gear through a lonely midnight creek bottom would be the cause and reason for all your agony and frustration and outrage and grief and shame and irreparable loss, and that not even a white man but a nigger. And you still had the pistol with at least one of the old original 10 German bullets in it. But don't worry, he said quickly. Don't worry about Mr. Hampton. He probably won't even draw his pistol. I ain't certain, in fact, that he has one, because he has a way of carrying right along with him into all situations, maybe not peace, maybe not abatement of the base emotions, but at least a temporary stalemate of crude and violent behavior just by moving slow and breathing hard. This happened 2 or 3 terms ago, back in the 20s. A Frenchman's band lady, naming no names, at feud with another lady over something which began, we understood, over the matter of a prize cake at a church supper bazaar, whose, the second lady's husband, owned the still which had been supplying Frenchman's band with whiskey for years, bothering nobody until the first lady made official demand on Mr. Hampton to go out there and destroy the still and arrest the operator. And then, in about a week or 10 days, came into town herself and told him that if he didn't, she was going to report him to the governor of the state and the president in Washington. So Hope went that time. She had not only given him explicit directions, but he said there was a path to it knee-deep in places where it had been trodden for years beneath the weight of stopper-full gallon jugs, so that you could have followed it even without the flashlight, which he had, and sure enough, there was the still in as nice a location as you could want. Cozy and sheltered, yet accessible too, with a fire burning under the kettle, and a Negro tending it, who, of course, didn't know who owned it, nor ran it, nor anything about it even, before he recognized Hampton's size and finally even saw his badge. who Hope said offered him a drink first, and then did fetch him a gourd of branch water, and then made him comfortable sitting against a tree, even chunking the fire up to dry his wet feet while he waited for the owner to come back. Quite comfortable, Hope said, the two of them there by the fire in the darkness talking about one thing and another, and the Negro asking him from time to time if he wouldn't like another gourd of water until Hampton said the mockingbird was making so confounded much racket that finally he opened his eyes, blinking for a while in the sunlight until he got them focused, and there the mockingbird was on a limb, not 3 feet above his head. And before they loaded up the still to move it away, somebody had gone to the nearest house and fetched back a quilt to spread over him and a pillow to put under his head. And Hope said he noticed the pillow even had a fresh slip on it when he took it and the quilt to Varner's store to be returned with thanks to whoever owned them and came on back to town. And another time... I'm not worrying, Miss Habersham said. Of course not, his uncle said. Because I know Hope Hampton. Yes, Miss Habersham said. I know Lucas Beecham. Oh, his uncle said. Then he said, yes. Then he said, of course. Then he said, let's ask Chick to plug in the kettle and we'll have coffee while we wait. What do you think? That will be nice, Miss Habersham said.